U.S. Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz is in Iowa to address ISU graduates. This hour, a conversation with Moniz about U.S. energy policy and where Iowa fits into the picture. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. After talking with Secretary Moniz, Iowa Public Radio's Sarah Bowden will tell us about the guilty verdicts against three former Ron Paul presidential campaign aides. Also, the story behind a hate crime this week in Iowa City, why the UI is putting counselors in dorms, and a conversation with a Des Moines high school teacher who may be making electoral college history. Buckle up for your Friday News Buzz. First, this news from NPR. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. U.S. Secretary of Energy Ernest Moniz is coming to Iowa this weekend to deliver the undergraduate commencement address at Iowa State University and to visit the Ames Laboratory. That's the site of a new facility for atomic-level research. Moniz is a nuclear physicist who has led the Department of Energy since May of 2013. And prior to that, Moniz served more than 40 years on the physics faculty at MIT. Secretary Moniz joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Ben. Appreciate it.
Today you will help dedicate the Department of Energy Ames Laboratory's new $9.9 million sensitive instrument facility. Tell us, what is this facility? Why is it needed?
Well, first of all, we have had a very long-standing relationship with Iowa State and the Ames Laboratory, literally going back to World War II. The laboratory is a leader in our materials programs and advanced materials, new materials, design materials, materials that we can synthesize, apply to many, many different energy technologies. This new facility will be one where because of the construction of the facility, the most sensitive instruments can be put in there. We will be putting in new various forms of microscopes, if you like, that can look at materials at the nanoscale, essentially down to the atomic scale, and that again will allow the design of new materials, the synthesis of the materials, the characterization of the materials, so that they can be applied in everything from high efficiency operation of thermal power plants to new kinds of membranes that can separate things like carbon dioxide to the critical materials that are a specialty of Ames, looking at how we can be secure in our need for things like rare earth elements that are key to a whole bunch of technology. So this is really very, very central to our entire program. It will serve not only Iowa State, but scientists across the country.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about renewable energy policy. Iowa generates more than 30% of its energy from wind power. And at the same time, this is a state where the construction of a new crude oil pipeline across the state has met with some great controversy. I wonder, Secretary Moniz, how you see the old and new forms of energy complementing each other rather than competing against each other, which seems to be the case when we listen to the news often.
That's a very good point, Ben. First of all, Iowa is obviously the leader in terms of wind as a fraction of electricity delivery, and not only is it above 30% now, but meeting with the governor earlier today, it's clear that we are headed here in Iowa to 40% by the end of this decade. Now, how that works in the again, in this idea of coexistence with more traditional forms of energy, and certainly in many places. We should first emphasize that natural gas, which of course is abundant in the United States, is very complementary to sources like wind and solar, because natural gas plants can be ramped up and down to level the load when the wind is blowing harder or not blowing, for example. In terms of oil, let me say that, first of all, oil in the United States plays a negligible role in terms of electricity, but obviously is critical for transportation. But even as we produce much more oil, and we do, we were up to about 4 million barrels per day increase over the last several years. It's gone down a little bit now with the lower oil prices. But even as we do that, we cannot lose sight of the fact that we remain large oil importers. As such, we continue to focus on lowering our oil dependence, and for that we have three major directions. One is continuous increase in the efficiency of our vehicles to use less fuel. Secondly, to continue electrification of vehicles. And third, and clearly very important to Iowa, is the continued effort to develop alternative fuels, in particular biofuels, and in particular next generation cellulosic biofuels that use more like agricultural waste, like corn stover. And here in Iowa, in addition to being the leader in producing what I would call traditional ethanol, there are biorefineries that we are helping support that can be the next generation of using this agricultural waste, for example, for biofuels, and I might add biochemicals that can substitute for petrochemicals.
Mm-hmm. We were once told, Secretary, years ago, at the beginning of the ethanol boom, that we would become the Saudi Arabia of biofuels. So you're saying that the corn ethanol is going to be fading out, and we will have other types of renewable biofuels coming into the picture in greater quantities in the future?
Well, okay, I didn't quite say fading out, but let's clarify the situation is that, first of all, any of our new clean energy technologies, whether it's in the fuels or in the power sector, go through this learning curve, if you like, where with time, cost and performance are improved. That's true, first of all, for corn ethanol. For example, the CO2 footprint of corn ethanol has gone from, a decade ago, the argument was whether the CO2 footprint was equal to or worse than a petroleum-based fuel. Today, we are seeing a footprint probably 20% below petroleum-based fuels. However, the cellulosic, the next generation, has many attractive features, of course, working down the costs and improving performance. Number one, the CO2 footprint, the life cycle CO2 footprint, will be vastly improved over both petroleum-based fuels and corn ethanol. Secondly, the obvious attraction of being able to use waste products, which have no other major use, is, of course, attractive as opposed to using a feedstock that can be used and is used, of course, very, very widely for other purposes. So I think it's a progression in our technology and one that I think will lead to a very strong role, continuing role, for biomass in our energy economy.
Mm-hmm. Yesterday, the apparent Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump made a campaign stop in West Virginia, coal country. He addressed a huge rally. He said he would put miners back to work, and he lamented the current state of coal country. What are your thoughts when you hear such, well, back-to-the-future promises, back to more coal production in this country?
Well, first of all, of course, let me make it very clear. I'm not going to comment on the positions of any individual candidate. But to answer your question more broadly, again, first of all, the shift in our electricity sector from roughly a half coal to now about a third coal over the last decade, let me emphasize that has been principally a marketplace-driven shift because of the very low cost domestically of natural gas. So that's been a business dynamic that I would think our business sector would clearly understand. Now, even as we say that, and as we are no doubt heading to continuously lower carbon future, we invest very heavily in developing the new technologies that will allow coal to be a competitor in a low-carbon marketplace. Most specifically, that includes new technologies that will continue the cost reduction of carbon dioxide capture. It includes novel technologies that can utilize carbon dioxide on a very, very large scale. And in a different direction, it includes programs that specifically help us to address the dislocations that have obviously been felt in coal communities. I might add, the governor this morning emphasized how in southwestern Iowa, the development of the biofuels, biorefinery concepts are providing economic opportunity in an area that did in the past produce coal. So I think that's the key. We have to provide the alternatives, for coal use in a low-carbon future, and we have to provide the assistance for the economic transformation of some of these regions.
Secretary of Energy Moniz, as the Energy Secretary, you were tasked when you came into this office in 2013 with advancing President Obama's so-called all-of-the-above energy strategy, reducing the threat caused by the proliferation of nuclear weapons, promoting American leadership in clean energy technology, cleaning up the legacy of the Cold War, and strengthening energy management and performance. What has been the challenge that causes you most concern?
Well, I'm not sure. It's hard to distinguish concern and opportunity. And you've mentioned two of the highest priority areas for President Obama for which we have responsibility. One is we need to keep this drive towards a low-carbon, clean, secure, and affordable energy future. The Paris Agreement was a major step in that direction. Now we have to implement. I feel, and it's probably my own scientific background that leads me to emphasize especially the issues of energy science and technology innovation as core. I'd like to mention that the Paris Agreement was a very, very important and large first step. But I emphasize first step because it provides strong commitments by the countries of the world for the next 10 to 15 years. But we all know beyond that, to reach our goals, such as 2 degrees or less centigrade warming, that we will need even more ambition beyond that horizon. I think technology innovation that continues cost reduction and provides new services for the public is central to that increased ambition. So we continue to work on that. I guess a concern is that we need to see Congress providing the kinds of resources that we need, an increase specifically in the innovation budgets that will allow us to pursue this most effectively and to work with the investor community to see the new technologies deployed expeditiously at large scale. So that's one of the major areas. The other, you alluded to it briefly, quite different from the clean energy agenda, is the Department of Energy does have major nuclear security responsibilities. An example of that recently in the news was our central role in the Iran negotiations, but more broadly, we have responsibilities for working to secure and, to the extent possible, eliminate nuclear materials that we certainly don't want to see, for example, in the hands of terrorists or organized crime across the world. So that's another major issue. There are considerable risks. Frankly, we saw recently in the Belgian tragedy how ISIL may be showing interest in nuclear materials. That just shows why this is such an important problem. President Obama started in 2010 a nuclear security summit series. We just had one in March, April in D.C. That has really brought this issue to the attention of global leaders. And we're making real progress. where, but again, you can say it's a half-empty, half-full situation. We've eliminated many materials across the world. We have much more to do yet. So those are the two very, very big areas where we work real hard at it in support of the president's priorities.
Secretary Moniz, before we say goodbye, I'd just like to ask, when you're speaking at commencement ceremonies for the graduates of Iowa State University tomorrow, what is the thrust of your message to them as the next generation of engineers and scientists?
Well, first of all, Iowa State, you're mentioning engineers and scientists, and of course Iowa State is, I would say, particularly strong in the areas of, well, agriculture, science, and engineering. I believe, and again, I come from that community as a physicist, and I believe that what we are good at is problem solving. So I think these young people are going to be, you know, the problem solvers of tomorrow. And we've just talked about two of the critical areas where their talents will be needed: the clean energy agenda and the nuclear security agenda. Certainly on the former, there is no doubt they are going to be living through this period where we will have to come to grips and mitigate the impacts of global warming. We need to recognize that as we mitigate, we will still need to adapt to some of the impacts that we are already seeing. They will see it. Their children will see it. They have to pick up the flag, if you like, and provide the kinds of technology solutions, but also policy solutions to the extent that they are directly involved in that space, and also very important, business model solutions. The world will look different in this arena, and those who are flexible and adaptable in the technology space and the business space, I think the ones are the ones who will be succeeding. I might say, again, this morning here in Iowa, we saw how the strong development of renewable energy in Iowa is not, as some would argue, in tension with business development. It's been the opposite. It's been used as an opportunity for development, indeed for attracting businesses like Google and Microsoft to this state because of their desire to have low environmental footprints. So I think that's kind of what these young scientists and engineers and business school people and lawyers and across the board, that's what they will need to do: solve these problems and solve them in ways that continue to improve quality of life, are certainly very affordable for them and their fellow citizens.
Okay. Thank you very much, U.S. Secretary of Energy Ernest Moniz in Iowa, to address Iowa State University graduates tomorrow in Ames. Secretary Moniz, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The jury returned across-the-board guilty verdicts yesterday in the federal conspiracy trial of three senior staffers from former Texas Congressman Ron Paul's 2012 presidential campaign. Iowa Public Radio's Sarah Bowden covered the trial. She joins us now. Hello, Sarah.
Hey, Ben.
Give us briefly the facts of the case and tell us what these staffers were found guilty of.
Right. So Kent Sorensen had been the Iowa chair of Michelle Bachmann's 2012 presidential campaign. And then days before the Iowa caucuses in 2012, he jumped ship, switched to the Paul campaign. And then it eventually came out that he was being paid by the Paul campaign. And this was a violation of Senate ethics rules. And then through examination of invoices and FEC documents, it was found that his payments were being disguised as audio-visual expenses. And the government successfully argued in federal district court in Des Moines here that this was a violation of federal election law.
Mm-hmm. And Kent Sorensen, a former Iowa State senator. So what sentence do these three face?
So these guys could spend decades in prison, but their sentencing doesn't happen until September of this year. So, I mean, it's really hard to say what Judge John Jarvie will think is appropriate. I have no idea.
Mm-hmm. When Sorensen dramatically switched his support from Michelle Bachmann to Ron Paul, well, what was his involvement in Bachmann's campaign?
Yeah, so he was the Iowa chair of her campaign. So this was, he had testified in court that he was working, you know, 60, 70 hours a week. At the time, he was very prominent in Tea Party circles. So this was a very dramatic switch. And if you recall, and I'm sure you do, Ben, that Bachmann and former Congressman Ron Paul were vying for the same sort of Republican voters, Tea Party, anti-establishment, libertarian leaning. So this was very dramatic.
Mm-hmm. This was a quick verdict. Was that expected?
Yeah, this was a relatively quick verdict. And, you know, I wasn't in the jury room, so I don't, you know, I'm not privy to those conversations. But the previous trial, because this was the second trial in this case, the first ended in a hung jury in October. And the previous trial, that took 2 days of deliberation and it ended in a hung jury. And, you know, this time around, it was less than a day. And I have a couple guesses as to why the jury A was able to reach a verdict this time and why it took them less time. One is that a conspiracy requires a group of people to be in agreement. And John Tate, the campaign director of Ron Paul's 2012 campaign, was not part of the previous trial. His charges were dismissed after the judge found that the government had violated an immunity agreement with Mr. Tate. So, but this time around, he was on trial. And so I think the government prosecutors had an easier time arguing that with all three members of the conspiracy, include, and then Ken Sorensen, that what they claimed had happened had happened. Also, defense lawyers were not allowed to use the expert testimony of an election law professor. This time around, Judge John Jarvie ruled that he felt it wasn't appropriate, that he got far too into talking about what was and wasn't legal, and he felt that that was not appropriate and was confusing to the jury. And I think that probably really hurt the defense's case.
Mm-hmm. What has been the reaction to these across-the-board guilty verdicts?
Well, I was in the courtroom when the verdict was read, and it was incredibly emotional. Jesse Benton, who was the campaign chair, his wife started crying. Of course, the defendants were very ashen, and it was very emotional.
Mm-hmm. We were expecting an appeal.
Yes, there's going to be an appeal. I spoke to Dimitri Kasari's attorney, Jesse Benal. Dimitri Kasari, by the way, was the deputy campaign manager. And Mr. Benal said there will be an appeal because throughout the trial, his defense had been, it isn't clear that what these men were accused and convicted of doing is actually legal. And so that's going to be a legal question for a court of appeals, and maybe even the Supreme Court.
Okay, thank you very much, Sarah Bowden, talking about federal jurors returning a guilty verdict yesterday in a host of public corruption charges against three former Ron Paul presidential campaign aides accused of a secret plot to pay an Iowa State senator $73,000 for his endorsement. Thanks so much, Sarah.
Thanks, Ben.
Coming up in just a moment on this edition of River to River, our News Buzz edition, why the University of Iowa is putting counselors in dorms, the story behind a hate crime in Iowa City, and a conversation with a high school teacher in Des Moines who may be making electoral college history. That's when we return to this News Buzz edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a few minutes.
Support for IPR comes from Hans Jewelers, featuring two levels of fine jewelry and gifts since 1854. 109 East Washington Street in downtown Iowa City. Hans Jewelers, joining others in support of nonprofit organizations. Additional support comes from the craftsmen at the Amana Furniture and Clock Shop in the Village of Amana, specialists in handcrafting solid walnut, oak, and cherry furniture and clocks. Custom-made furniture available to fit individual tastes. Showroom open daily or online at amanafurniture.com.
Rock and roll, babies. This is Bob Dorp. I've got lots of spotlight segments on Backtracks this week, including some song comparisons between the hit version and its not-so-popular original version. I'll have some LPs that I got for a dollar, including Commander Cody and Pavlov's Dog, and some collector's items from Pink Floyd and Janis Joplin. It's a potpourri spotlight segment edition of Backtracks, Saturday afternoon, 2 to 5 on Iowa Public Radio Studio 1.
And we're back on this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Still to come, a conversation with a Des Moines high school teacher who may be making Electoral College history. But before that, on Monday of this week, University of Iowa freshman Marcus Owens was attacked by three white men who were shouting racial slurs. Owens is black. Police are investigating the incident as a hate crime, and criticism has followed that the University of Iowa mishandled the situation. Jeff Carice Carlson is with me, higher education reporter for the Iowa City Press Citizen, to discuss this assault. Hello, Jeff.
Hello, Ben.
So tell us, what happened on Monday to Marcus Owens?
Well, Monday was when Marcus Owens actually reported this for the first time. The attack actually happened on Saturday night, he said. He was in downtown Iowa City, in an alleyway off of Iowa Avenue, when he was attacked by three white college-age men who, in the midst of beating him, he says, were shouting racial slurs. That night, he went to the hospital where he was treated with 15 stitches in his lip for a broken blood vessel in his eye and for some broken front teeth as well. His family say that he was in the hospital all day Sunday and was released Monday morning. And then he went to the University of Iowa Police to report the incident on Monday night. That's when the story gets a little even more complicated. The University of Iowa Police, when he went in to give the report, as soon as they heard where the incident had taken place, which is off campus, they said, that's out of our jurisdiction. We don't want you to have to tell this story again. We'll just stop you right here and you should go to the Iowa City Police, which he proceeded to do. The next day, as the Iowa City Police were investigating, word got out about Marcus Owens' injuries, and media, out-of-state media and some local media started contacting the university asking what's happening. We hear a black UI student was attacked by three white men. That's when the university didn't know, or their communications people didn't know the answer, suddenly news broke from a Chicago television station, about 7 o'clock news, about this, which suddenly made the UI community aware of something that had happened 3 days earlier.
So the University of Iowa being accused of mishandling, not making people aware quick enough, and the university, for those who don't live in the Iowa City community, Coralville community, there are alerts of certain types that
there
can
are,
go on.
Usually, by federal law, they are required to issue an alert of ongoing threats on the campus. In this case, they said they simply did not know. Had Marcus Owens been allowed to give a little more information on Monday, the university probably would have known. What happened was then, after social media and I'm sure emails and other calls to the university exploded on Wednesday morning, they got the information from Iowa City Police and then finally did issue kind of a campus-wide crime alert about what had happened, owned up to it, and UI administration then met with Marcus Owens and his family to find accommodations for him academically for the rest of the semester, as well as the medical care that he needs.
So in the minute or so that we have left, the University of Iowa sees room for improvement in its protocol here?
They say that originally that policy was in place to make sure that victims didn't have to be re-victimized, that they didn't have to tell their story to one officer and then be sent over to another officer and have to tell the same story
again. I've talked to so many people in your chair, victims of crimes who've said, I had to tell my story five times. And so this is this re-victimization they're trying to avoid.
But in this case, the Marcus Owens' family is pretty clear that instead of being a victim-centered process, it actually caused more harm in this process. If they had asked a few more questions, they would have had a lot more information earlier on and seen the situation as being as volatile as it was, and had the information out to the community earlier than Wednesday morning. And the president has said that they are reevaluating that policy as a result.
Mm-hmm. Okay, of course, the last question I want to get to is any arrests? Have these three white men been found?
Nah, I did not call the police right before I came on here, unless something's happened in this. Usually I would expect that if somebody is made an arrest, they'll have some kind of press conference on this. The last we checked in, they have some persons of interest. They have identified some suspects. But they're still moving forward with the investigation.
Okay. Jeff Caris-Carlson, higher education reporter for the Iowa City Press Citizen, talking about a hate crime that occurred last weekend, reported on Monday. Thank you very much, Jeff, for coming in.
All right. Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Mental health continues to be a big issue for college campuses around the nation and here in Iowa. One in every three students reports prolonged periods of depression. One in four reports suicidal thoughts. Now, the University of Iowa is taking a new approach to promote mental health. It's placing counselors in the dorms themselves. Barry Schreier is with us. He's director of the University Counseling Services, also clinical professor of psychology at the UI. Hi, Barry.
Hi.
Tell us more about this new plan and the thinking behind it.
Sure. So we are embedding counselors across the campus. This is actually a movement in the larger Big Ten university system. So there are other Big Ten counseling centers that are doing this. And the idea behind it is that each population on our campus has its own needs. And given that the size of our Big Ten schools are so large, it's often hard for students to get from one side of the campus to the other to seek services. So if we can place counselors in a population so that the counselor understands the culture of that population, the ebb and flow of how students use services, and they're in a geographic proximity to where the students are, we're hoping that students will make even greater use of our services.
Mm-hmm. Has this been tried anywhere else? Is this theory at this point, or do we know that by putting counselors in the dorms just a few doors down from where students are living, that they are more likely to go there when they're in need of mental health services?
So not here at the University of Iowa do we have the data, but on a couple of other Big Ten campuses, Ohio State, Northwestern University, have been doing this for a couple of years and are showing great results and great promise with that.
Mm-hmm. How does this figure into this? We've had earlier discussions, the stigma attached with getting help. Does that address that at all? I would think that if you would see, you know, your dorm mate walking into the counselor's office there, right where you live, that might be a problem.
Yeah, it's a great question. So we're very thoughtful about how someone's embedded into what we call a cohort population. So we're very thoughtful about where that office should be, sort of what the infrastructure is around that office. So again, the idea of, oh, we don't want somebody like, oh, we'll put the counselor right into the dining hall, and so you can get sort of your dinner or lunch and then go see the therapist, and everybody will watch you do that. So we're very thoughtful about where that office should be. So A, it's accessible, and B, it's in a location that actually does provide some privacy for the person seeking those services. Mm-hmm. But I will say this, you know, there's lots of talk about stigma. You know, we don't ever hurt for business. You know, while there might be stigma still, and I think we'll never completely eradicate it, in the last many years, we have done such a good job at reducing stigma. Students are coming for counseling in sort of unprecedented numbers.
So there's an increased demand across
there
the
is.
Board.
That's okay. Right. We've done a really good job with
and
that.
And you attribute that to raising awareness and lowering the stigma?
Yeah, that's correct.
Uh-huh.
Yep.
So help us understand, because you, I, others listening, many of the others listening have been a few years since we've been in college, if we were in college. So what is at the root of these concerns that students generally come in with in 2016? What is at the root of the concerns, the depression, even the suicidal thoughts?
Sure. So it is a changing times. It's much different than what it was when you and I perhaps were in college. And one of the things that we know about this generation of students is, despite all the things that they have that they're really gifted at, they are the most civically minded generation we had in decades. They are very attached. They think they can do anything because they can get their hands on any information that they want at the drop of a hat. They're so connected. But one of the things that this generation is not very good at, and it's just not their gift, every generation has its good sides and its bad sides. This generation's downside is they don't emotionally regulate very well. They just don't know how to sort of handle their own emotions. When they feel bad, they think something's wrong. When they are sad, they think that they should be able to do something about that immediately, because that's how they view the world, is do anything you want. And when their emotions don't change quickly, they think something's terribly wrong with them and that they are failing. Mm-hmm. It's the blue ribbon generation where everybody got a ribbon.
You've already embedded a counselor in the College of Dentistry, I understand.
Yep. So we have somebody in the College of Dentistry. We also have just recently hired someone into the Department of Athletics. Mm-hmm. And in the fall, as you know, we will be embedding someone into the Eastside Residence Hall system. Mm-hmm.
Tell me about the people, the specific people you've sought out to fill these positions and will be filling in the dorm positions.
Yep. So we're looking for staff therapists, and we're looking for folks who are very skilled in what I would call broad generalist skills, meaning that they can basically be a Jack or a Jane of all trades, because anything that can walk in the door does walk in the door. And unlike what we typically look for if we're just staffing the university counseling service in the mothership, as I call it, is we're looking for someone who's got entrepreneurial skills, because it's going to be a startup. Mm-hmm. They have to basically start up a brand new office, understand the culture in which that office is placed, and generate a service that's going to meet the needs of the students that they're serving.
And entrepreneurial skills means you'll be looking for feedback from them about what works and what doesn't.
Yeah, they're going to have to sort of know the outcomes, is what we're doing working. They're going to have to know how to market a service. And so mm-hmm. they're going to have to engage in communications and marketing, and then be good clinicians on top of all of that. And then wonderful liaisons and diplomats for the service, because it's all going to be about building relationships within that culture to make the service work. Mm-hmm.
Any input from parents on this move, or any consideration there that parents think this is a good idea?
You know, that's a really good question. We're going to be rolling into summer orientation very soon, where all the first-year students, parents, and families are going to come rolling through the university in preparation of their children coming to our campus in the fall, and it'll be something we'll want to ask them. The other thing we said is this would be a really great thing for the residence halls to market, to say, you know, send your student to our housing system at the University of Iowa, and we have our own therapist. Mm-hmm. And so we're thinking that it's going to be a really good marketing tool as well for parents.
The University of Iowa has ranked very low, if not at the bottom in the Big Ten, in terms of resources put towards mental health. Is this sort of a catch-up move?
In some ways, it is a catch-up move. Is we certainly benchmark ourselves against our other Big Ten colleagues, and then we also have our national accreditation standards, and we're low on those as well. And so this is a way for us to catch up with the need. The thing I always say is that if mental health is one of the greatest healthcare concerns on our campus, and it's the number one reason why students decide to take leave from campus is due to mental health reasons, then we have to then take a look at the resource we have available to meet the health concern. And if the disparity is too great, then we're going to have lots of things fall through the cracks.
Mm-hmm. How do you measure that? How do you know when you have enough resources, or how many resources you're short?
Sure. So we have national accreditation standards. University counseling centers can accredit themselves based on national standards. And the upper rate for that, based on their numbers, is that we should have one staff person in the counseling service for every 1,500 students at most. And at current, at the University of Iowa, we're one to about 2,800 students. So we're far outside the even maximum number allowed for accreditation standards. So that is one metric we use to measure ourselves by.
Okay. Thank you very much, Barry Schreier, Director of the University Counseling Services at the University of Iowa, Clinical Professor of Psychology at the UI, talking about the University of Iowa's new approach to promoting mental health among students, placing counselors right in the dorms. Thanks, Barry.
Voila. Thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Last Saturday, Democrats held district conventions in all four of Iowa's congressional districts, and they chose their national delegates and electors. One of those electors is Jack Schuler, an English teacher at Lincoln High School in Des Moines, and he may be making history. While the Democratic Party has had transgender delegates previously, it's possible that Jack, who was born as Elise Schuler, is the first transgender elector in Iowa and possibly in the nation. Jack Schuler joins me now. Welcome to you.
Hi.
Hi, Jack. So remind us, what's the difference between a delegate and an elector?
Well, a delegate is a person who goes to the national convention and then votes for the candidate that they want to see run in the general election in November. The elector, however, after the votes are cast and the totals are in November, the elector then casts that representative vote as part of the Electoral College.
Mm-hmm. So I understand there were a few people who wanted to be the elector for your district. So what did you had to give a small speech? You had to pitch for yourself to be the elector? What did you say?
Well, we all had 1-minute speeches because it was pushing midnight by that point. So we all agreed we'd keep ourselves to a minute. But I just came right out and I spoke from the heart. And I thanked the group for being so committed to democracy and to voting for what they believed was right, because it allowed me to exist openly as a transgender person in this nation.
Mm-hmm. And what was the response?
It was overwhelmingly positive. I didn't hear a single negative comment from anybody.
So you're getting a lot of visibility here in the press due to the facts that you could be making history in the way that I previously mentioned. How do you feel about that? All this focus on you as an elector because you're transgender.
I really didn't realize in the moment when I was running for elector how much attention I would be getting. I'm still kind of overwhelmed. I listen to River to River myself and IPR, and to be contacted by you it's almost surreal.
So how do you feel about the attention?
As surreal as some of it feels, I think it's a great opportunity for me to represent, and also a huge responsibility. But I feel like now I can be someone who can be a representative for the transgender community. Just today, I had a student at my school come up to me and tell me she had read the article in the Des Moines Register where I was mentioned to be transgender, and the student told me, "I am too, but I'm not out of the closet yet, but I think I'm going to do it next year." So just to be able to be that kind of mentor to people is great.
It's been a long time, Jack, since I've attended high school, a long time since most of those listening to this conversation have been in high school. And I have to ask, how are you treated as an openly transgender high school teacher here in Iowa?
Oh, it's great. My administration knows, the district knows, everybody's been very supportive, very accepting. My colleagues, they're great, they're supportive. The GSA at the school is throwing me a party in a couple weeks. My students are also really happy for me. Even students that I don't teach stop me in the hall and, you know, they show me their love and their support.
Does it ever come up in conversation with students in class?
After I came out to the school's Gay Straight Alliance, one of the members of the Gay Straight Alliance, one of our straight allies, asked if she could make an announcement during our class period, because she's also in my English class. And she stood up, she made the announcement, and the whole class clapped and cheered for me. So, I mean, it comes up, but the support is still there.
What was that moment like when you got the applause?
It was a very warm moment, and it was touching. I almost didn't know what to say, and thinking back on it, I actually start to get a little choked up.
May I ask how old you are, Jack?
I'll be 33 in July.
So you've seen some years where transgender people have been treated differently. So you feel this nation, this state is on the cusp of some change here.
Definitely. When I was growing up, the word transgender wasn't in my vocabulary when I was the age of my students. I mean, I started high school in 1997, graduated in 2001, and during the late 90s was when the first major celebrities like George Michael and Ellen DeGeneres really started coming out of the closet and being open celebrities. And the word transgender, we just weren't talking about it. It was like this entire demographic was invisible.
As you're well aware, I'm sure transgender rights have become a major part of the political conversation this year. With laws some are calling discriminatory in places like South Carolina, and of course the controversy over Target's bathroom policy, where Target says you use the bathroom of the gender that you identify with. What's your take? What do you believe needs to be done to ensure equal rights?
Obviously, as you can imagine, I am totally against the laws banning transgender people from the bathrooms of the gender they identify with, especially if those who have had the reassignment surgeries or those who are further along in their hormone replacement therapy, if they walk into the bathroom they identify with, they look like they belong there. There's this sort of notion that a guy in a dress is going to sneak into the women's room, and it's completely false. And I appreciate places like Target that allow me to use the restroom I identify with. And I believe some Kroger's have actually introduced gender-neutral bathrooms as well as some other places. because, well, if you see me in the restroom, I'm there for the same reason you are.
Well, what do you say, Jack, to those who are on the other side of this argument with the bathrooms or whatever, or transgender rights, that you should not be treated equally in certain respects as a transgender person?
For those people, I would ask them to take the time to meet me or meet another trans person. Get to know us, see who we are, and see that we're human beings just like you. There's really nothing deep down in our core that separates us from each other. And I think that once the people who are on the opposite side of the issue for me start to get to know transgender people, they'll revise their opinions.
Jack, you're clearly very politically involved, of course, as an elector. The Democratic Convention is coming up this summer. I wonder, how do you hope the platform will be developed concerning LGBT issues?
I feel that the Democratic platform is already moving in the right direction as far as having inclusive LGBTQ rights, and I feel like the Democratic Party is among the two main parties, the one doing the best work. I'm sure there are some third parties out there that are also supporting LGBTQ rights as well, but I feel like the Democratic Party is really on the cusp of shaping this whole conversation and this whole movement in a positive direction.
All right. Jack Schuler, thanks for this conversation. An English teacher at Lincoln High School in Des Moines. Jack could be the first openly transgender presidential elector from Iowa and perhaps the nation. Thank you, Jack, for this conversation.
Thank you.
Before we go today, I just want to mention on Monday we'll be talking about bike safety. In the last 5 years, 22 bicyclists have been killed by motor vehicles on Iowa's roadways. The penalty for most of those drivers, a $250 fine. So we'll talk about what some say is a failure of Iowa law when it comes to protecting bicyclists. Bicyclists, do you feel safe on Iowa's roads? You want to tune in Monday at this time for another edition of River to River. River to River, produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Catherine Perkins is our executive director. I'm Ben Kiefer. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Have a wonderful weekend.